of peace. Her name is Sarah Ruddick. She is a professor, instructor in philosophy and women's studies at Eugene Lang College. And the book, as you listen to us talk, I think you'll get a better understanding. But just to give you a very brief kind of introduction, she makes the case in the book that various kinds of activities, pursuits, bring about in the practitioner a certain way of thinking and a way of looking at the world, and that is true of mothering as it is true of a lot of other things. She also, as you will discover, takes a fairly broad definition of mothering. It is more to her than simply a biological act. So it is possible that it's something a man could do, although traditionally it has been done by women. And she says that it causes you to think about the world in certain sorts of ways, and that kind of thinking is innately anti-militarist. And that because of that, people who spend a lot of time mothering are, in a sense, ready-made to be peacemakers. I think that is not, I'm not doing an injustice to the ideas in the book, and you will get a chance to learn more as we talk, and also to react to what Professor Ruddick has to say. Let me give you our telephone number. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Our toll-free line is 800-222-9455. At any point here, perhaps you'll have questions or you would like to react to what our guest has to say. You'll share your own thoughts with us. Please do that. Professor Ruddick, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. I hope that I did an adequate enough job at least to start off.
Well, you certainly did. If I could only say one small thing,
yes.
And that is that I don't think mothers are innately peaceful, or the maternal thinking is innately anti-militarist.
Okay.
So many mothers are avid supporters of wars. History has shown that. What I do think is that maternal thinking could become anti-militarist.
All right.
And that mothers, as you said, are set to become peacemakers, even though they are not yet reliably peacemakers.
There is no guarantee that...
Not only no guarantee, but there's a real history of maternal militarism. And it's perfectly understandable that mothers would be, like most people, would be loyal to their governments and certainly to their sons who are fighting, for example.
Well, I think probably the place to start is to have you talk a little bit about what you mean when you use the term mothering, because as I try to explain that, I think that you have a particular meaning in mind and that it is more than biology, so it has more to do with giving. It is more than giving birth. It's also more than, one might be tempted to use a word like parenting, but there seems to be something more to it than that. When you think about it, what do you mean by mothering?
Well, you said it exactly right. I think of it as a kind of work. The part of the work that takes place in earliest infancy is an extremely small part of it. Mothering goes on for years, years and years. In fact, I don't think really people ever stop mothering their children. And if you think of the problems of the work, the problems of a child left out of a birthday party, the problems of a teenager who is tempted to be on drugs, these are the kinds of problems that anyone doing the work may confront, depending on the culture they live in and so on. And that kind of work can be done as well, I believe, by men as by women.
Mm-hmm.
There might be biological differences between men and women mothers. We don't know that, really. But I don't see any reason why, in principle, or ahead of the fact, we can say that men can't be just as good as mothers as women.
Hmm. Some people, I think, would be prepared to agree with you to a point, although they might say that there is still something very special about the fact that the woman carries the child inside her and gives birth, and that's still the thing that men can't do, and that somehow that means there will be a bond or that it will affect a woman in a way that a man cannot be affected.
Well, I distinguish mothering from birth giving. Mm. And birth giving is, of course, something only women do. I then talk about all mothers as being adoptive, in that any mother, man or woman, makes a social commitment when they take upon themselves the commitment to protect and nourish a child. I'm not sure, but I've talked to a lot of adopting parents. I think it's probably very likely that in the very earliest months of infancy, the birth mother has a different connection with her infant than either a man or a woman who has adopted a child without giving birth. But I don't think that in the whole scope of mothering work, in the whole scope of a lifetime, that difference is either great or predictable.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's very important. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about birth, and I think it's very important to honor female birth givers. And one of the things I think that maternal thinkers can do, whether men or women, is to begin to think about birth differently and honor those female birth givers.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the business of mothering, you suggest that there are maybe three major components or three major activities, broadly defined, that one is involved in. And I'd like to perhaps talk a little bit about each of those things.
Mm-hmm.
and the ways, and then it seems you go on to suggest that the fact that one is involved in those things leads one to think in certain ways or perhaps think about the world in certain ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it does change. It changes one and how you feel about things. So perhaps we could talk a little bit about each of these things. The first, perhaps the most fundamental, maybe the one that comes closest to instinct, although I don't know how you'd feel about using that word, is simply the business of preservation, of protecting the fact that babies, when they come into the world, and children for a lot of their life, really do need to be protected from things, and that maybe the most elemental role, the strongest sort of gut feelings that a parent has, comes from the desire to protect, you know, to almost to physically put yourself in between the child and whatever threat you might see.
Yes, you put it very well. Yes.
Where does that come from, do you think? Is it in fact a kind of instinctual thing?
I don't think we can use the word instinct easily, certainly, because there are cultures where mothers and birth-giving mothers let their children die. And in particular, there's a study done by Elizabeth Badinter in France about mothers in 18th century France who sent their babies out to be wet-nursed, even though they knew that made it very likely they wouldn't survive. But certainly from being a mother and talking to mothers, there is something enormously compelling that seems to come from one's whole being about the desire to, I think, how did you put it very well, stand between your child and the danger that it might suffer. And what's very interesting about this work is that mothers do this despite very often being furious at their children, hassled themselves about their other parts of their lives and whatever. I mean, they commit themselves to protection despite the fact their children are provocative and that they're often powerless and hassled by all sorts of other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, in what way do you think that affects one's view of the world and what is happening?
Well, this is a very interesting place to actually look at it. I think, I would hope that mothers who have protected their children could continue to protect their children and the world's children from the kinds of violences that war and poverty and racism are examples of. And I think certain kinds of thinking that arises, for example, the deep knowledge that you cannot control the world and that your best efforts won't guarantee safety. I talk about this a lot in the book. This could lead you to be very suspicious of violence and force and just trying to make things safe for children. On the other hand, mothers could also become militarist out of this, because they could say, only the army can protect my children. Mm-hmm. Only the army can protect my country, which has to be safe for my children. It's exactly the kind of place where I see this immense tension between the commitment of mothering to preserve lives, which goes against the military commitment to kill. And there's this tension between a mother's commitments on the one hand, and then on the other hand, she can go over and be prepared to kill if she's prepared to take other people's children as her enemy.
I think also, you know, this is a place where parents, I think, often feel tremendously frustrated, and it might really lead one to despair when you think about all of the dangers that your child is likely to be exposed to and how little you can really do about it. I mean,
that's
physically,
right.
You can't, I mean, you just can't, you cannot physically put yourself in between your child and the danger. So that might lead one to just get rather depressed because there is so much danger out there.
Yes, and I think I talk in the book about how a kind of resilient cheerfulness is necessary for this work of protection, and how parents are tempted to despair, and at the same time also tempted to be what I call cheery denial, but to deny the real evils of the world, to cheerily pretty things up. This resilient cheerfulness seems to me one of the characteristics of maternal thinking, one of the things that maternal thinkers identify as necessary to their work.
Hmm. Would it be trivializing it to say that one of the things that maternal practice develops in you, or maybe you would hope, is a sense of optimism that problems, no matter how large they seem, in some way can be confronted?
Yes, optimism and hope. And the danger in that is, if you think of, put yourself in the position of a child for the moment, the danger in that optimism is the temptation to cover things over, to pretend things are better than they are, not to call, like even whether it's domestic violence, whether it's social policies, whatever, for a mother not to say the truth about what's going on to the extent that a child needs truth. So that you have this conflict between the necessary hope you must have and the necessary hope your child must have and a child's need for some kind of truth that's genuinely caring truth, but nonetheless truth.
Our guest this morning is Sarah Ruddick. She's a professor, an instructor in philosophy and women's studies at Eugene Lang College. We're talking with her about some of the ideas in her book, Maternal Thinking Toward a Politics of Peace. Beacon Press is the publisher. I do have a caller I'd like to bring into the discussion rather than make them wait.
Right.
Others who are listening certainly are invited to. Our local lines are all open. The number is 333-9455. That's the local number. Our toll-free line is 800-222-9455. And we'll talk with someone right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm quite taken with that notion of resilient cheerfulness, but I wish I had some. I can't quite see it I'm sure it's a thing we should all possess, at least to a limited degree. But in a civilization with a politics such as ours, which is largely owned and operated by what seems to me gangs of political thugs, e.g. those that ran the Bush campaign, including Mr. Bush himself, in a civilization which is so totally dominated by its right wing, and its redundant, of course, plutocrat elements, in a civilization which seems so preoccupied with the politics of death, a la Mr. Spengler's idea of the Faustian spirit, which animates Western civilization. And I think it most assuredly, I was listening to this fellow, Mr. Gottmey, in your last hour, arguing for, obviously, more bucks, more clout for the military. Well, the military, it seems to me, as well as the most reactionary elements in the society, have it rather firmly in hand by its short hairs, if you'll pardon the expression. And I'd like to know what your guest thinks of this. I'd also like to... I recommend to anybody who's really concerned at the direction our civilization is taking, might I, two or three books, one of which was sort of the Bible of the college generation in the late 60s, early 70s, a book by Norman O. Brown called Life Against Death. Also, Dwayne Lockhart, The Perverted Priorities of American Politics. It seems to me that we should be spending approximately what we're spending on the military to cure environmental and miscellaneous other social ills, and approximately what we're spending on the environment and these other social ills to take care of the military, which is one way and another devouring the civilization alive, the military and such like institutions. And thank you.
All right. I will thank you for the comment. Professor Ruddick, maybe you have some reaction?
Well, I'm very much in sympathy with both the feelings and the views expressed by this caller. In one place in my book, I talk about the ways that maternal thinking and a kind of standpoint of care is contrasted with the perverted values that dominate our culture. So even the word he uses of perversion, I agree with entirely. I think that, if I can start from the peace politics point now and go back to mothers, I think it's very important if you're engaged in any kind of peace politics, and by that I mean any kind of politics that allows people to live together without killing each other in mutual respect, you're bound to suffer a great deal of despair in these days. And on the other hand, we should also say this is, partly because of Gorbachev, partly for other reasons, I think also a unique time of hope, so we shouldn't just emphasize the despair. But when you engage in any kind of project, whether it's something I've been thinking about recently, more adequate services for very young mothers, or whether it's trying to remove cruise missiles, you're going to feel an immense range of the forces against you, and you're going to never to know whether what you particularly have done has made that much difference. Not we all, but all across the country, there are people engaged in certain kinds of projects, union organizing, health projects, disarmament projects, and having minimal success, but some success, that has to somehow, we have to see as figuring into a larger picture. Now, if I can go from that view of peace politics back to mothers, I think that mothering is a kind of preparation for developing that resilient cheerfulness. Very few days with a child is good enough by the highest standards of the quote good mother. Numerous things disrupt a child's life, things that a mother couldn't possibly control, illness and accident, for example, as well as deep anguish the child suffers, which he can't understand and can't protect her or him from. And in the face of that, she has to continue to be, in some way, resiliently cheerful, not denying, but not despairing. Many mothers despair, and many peacemakers despair, so I think despair is an ever-present possibility. But mothering gives rise to, I think, another value and another virtue, which is resilient cheerfulness.
I suppose, you know, if you were going to look for one sort of word that would describe what is necessary for parenting, and if it has the proper effect on one, I think if you weren't that way when you started, you'd be that way when you finished, or else you wouldn't finish, and that is resilience. And what seems to come through to me is that you're saying is that if there's one thing the experience of mothering will do for one, it's to get to the point where you will bend with the breeze and recognize the limits of your power. I mean, yeah. there was only, you know, if we're talking about preservation, there's only so far one can go. If you're talking about trying to get your child to do what you want rather than sometimes what he or she wants,
right,
then you recognize there's definitely limitations of your power there, and that in some sense that, you know, even when you're thinking about parents wanting their children to grow up to be certain kinds of individuals, that even that is in some sense out of your hands, that it's
yes.
a process that runs a course of its own, and there's very little, in a sense, very little you can do about it. So if it's going to teach you anything, it's that flexibility and the limits of power.
But on the other hand, that you can't give up trying altogether. And the example you give of older, like adolescent children who are making moral choices that are, say, deeply disturbing and maybe even incomprehensible. But you can't just walk away and leave these children mm-hmm. or say, oh, this is another culture, so I'll be tolerant. You have to live with them despite this difference, which is very painful. And this, I think, is a very important element, too.
Yeah.
And, of course, many mothers do despair, and many mothers give up hope. But it's the struggle I'm trying to honor, not the achievement of mothers, but the struggle to stay hopeful despite reasons for despair. And that's what I think could be useful in peace politics, even necessary in peace politics.
The number here locally is 333-9455. The toll-free line, good anywhere that you hear us, is 800-222-9455. Maybe you have thoughts of your own you'd like to share with us as we talk with Sarah Ruddick. She teaches philosophy and women's studies at Eugene Lang College. She is the author of the book Maternal Thinking Toward a Politics of Peace, and the publisher of that book is Beacon Press. I wanted to ask you, I'm almost embarrassed to do this, but I didn't have the chance to check, and some people might be curious. Professor Ruddick, where is Eugene Lang College?
Actually, Eugene Lang College is part of the New School for Social Research.
Oh,
which
I
is,
see.
Have you heard of that?
Yes.
It's in New York City. It started as two things, an adult education and a graduate faculty, a university in exile during the time of the Second World War. And in 1972, in the New School, this small undergraduate college started as part of it. And my principal appointment is in that college. And then I teach I do teach one course in the graduate faculty and so forth. But that is my principal appointment.
I see. Very good. I wonder, as we talked about your view of the term mothering, and I wonder, in your thinking, how the term father contrasts with mother.
Well, this is one of the most controversial parts of the book, let me just tell you my thoughts, and then given the way I defined mothering, it's clear that men can do it as well, and therefore that men we usually call fathers are mothers. I mean, there's no need to distinguish father and mother there. I kept the term mothering because throughout history and still now, most of the people who have done the work of mothering have been women. And I wanted to honor the fact that I wanted to honor the women who've done the work, and I wanted to recognize that the fact the work has been done by women has some important effect on its character and on maternal thinking, so that I can look at different sort of writing, like, say, Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice, which is not about mothers, but about women, and find parallels or overlappings between what I say about mothers and what she says about women. A second thing, too, is I think the myth of fatherhood, I call it there, can be very destructive for men, where fatherhood is defined in terms of providing for your children and defending them. And a good enough father is supposed to be able to do that economically and do it in the face of the dangers of the world, especially for impoverished young fathers, young men, and for people who seem to have no options in life and life seems stacked against them, they can easily say, I can never be a father. Hmm. But they can engage in mothering work. Mothers, whatever their sex, have to go out and get the resources to care for their children. Women and men who are mothers have to do that. Very often, neither a woman nor a man can be a, quote, father in the way that men are expected to be fathers. And it's a very discouraging and demoralizing to be told, this is what you have to do. And I'm struck by, again, I've been reading a lot about adolescent mothers and adolescent pregnancy. I've been reading about the women, but the men come in there all the time, and over again you hear voices of young men saying, I would like to be a good father. That's the way they protect, they express themselves. But I can't be. There's no jobs, and so forth. And what I want to say is, well, here is a kind of work you can share to the best of your ability and demand, as all mothers should be able to demand, the resources that the society should give you to do that work.
You know, I wonder if some people also mightn't react in a kind of a similar way to the way that you have defined mothering, in the sense that you say that a lot of people would feel that they couldn't live up to this construct that we've come up with that's father and all of the various expectations of it. And that at the same time, what you've done for mothering is that, and you do say in the book that sometimes you meet this kind of criticism, that you are over-idealizing it. Or either that or somehow hauling that you're being reactionary, that you're hauling us back to a definition of motherhood that some people believe that we have progressed past as a result of the women's movement. I wonder how you react to that kind of criticism when you hear it.
Well, in one way I do is by saying that I am continuously talking about the efforts mothers make, the struggles they identify, and the cognitive abilities that are and ways of looking at the world that arise out of those struggles. I'm not talking about success. For example, to go back to the example we used before, I'm not saying that mothers are resiliently cheerful. I'm saying they recognize the necessity for resilient cheerfulness, but they fail all the time. I also talk about the ways the shadow of the good mother is very destructive, just as the shadow, I hadn't thought of it until you said it this way, but the shadow of the good father is destructive to men. The shadow of the good mother is destructive to women, too.
Sure.
And I think it's extremely important to stress the ambivalence, the confusion, the hatred for a child a mother can feel, and the ways in which all mothers, I believe, often feel that they are failing. But it's what they count as failure that I think is so critical here. Not that mothers fail, but that they have a certain ideal, and that ideal and the struggle to realize it is like the struggle to realize the ideals of peacefulness.
Is maternal thinking something that could be taught, or must it be learned in practice?
I think it is learned by children from their own mothers to a degree. And I never talk about mothers, but what people come up and tell me that they've had very bad mothers, but they didn't learn anything. But no one would have written the kind of book I wrote unless I'd learned a good deal about maternal thinking from my mother, who I'm visiting now, in fact. I think it can be learned there. I think it can certainly be learned on the job. But I believe, at least in the United States, and it could be different elsewhere, we should have a much more systematic effort to introduce into the curriculum all through the years, including right through and through college, different aspects of maternal thinking, and to begin to look at the work of mothering as a kind of work which gives rise to a specific challenges, which in turn gives rise to specific ways of thinking. That we could do this far more than we do now, so that you combine I don't think you can ever really prepare for mothering in advance, but you provide preparation for what will be coming, and also a respect for the work that mothers, that children know, a respect for the work that mothers are doing.
Yeah, I think that what I have understood many women to say about this experience, especially for the first time, is that there is some sort of societal expectation that women are genetically programmed to be mothers, and that, you know, as soon as they have the baby and the baby's handed to them, it's put in their arms, that automatically somehow this programming is going to slip into place, and that they'll know exactly what to do.
Yeah.
And that in many cases there is great frustration and difficulties because they really don't, and it's unfair to expect them and somehow I think we don't have those expectations of men. We don't expect them to automatically know, you know, what to do. But that women, because they had that baby, are somehow expected to be ready to go, and somehow not to need any help.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's true, and that's certainly that's a destructive myth for women to live with too. I mean, mothering is an ongoing learning process. My younger child is 23 now, and I'm still learning. So it's certainly nothing that you're genetically programmed to. And it's nothing you should have to do alone. I think mothers live much too much of their life in isolation now. Sometimes if they're in their workplace, they meet other mothers with whom they can talk. But when they're with their children, they're often very much alone. And I want to see... I mean, I have all sorts of utopian fantasies about changing the ways that the institutions of motherhood, the ways that mothers can be brought together and talk to each other and learn from each other.
It certainly has been the case, and as you point out, that over time, women have often been worked hard for peace, but. I wonder why, given the fact that maternal thinking, you're arguing that maternal thinking leads one to think in certain ways, and that perhaps might lead one to be a peacemaker, although there is no guarantee that that is going to happen. But why somehow women haven't been stronger voices against militarism, perhaps that may go back to the reality of women's status in society over time, and that would have been difficult or impossible for them to do.
Well, there is that, and some people have said when women generally or mothers specifically are powerful, then the world will be peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things within maternal work itself that I think are conducive to militarism. And in particular, maternal work starts with very passionate loyalties to very particular children and to very particular kin networks and very particular people. And in order to become peacemakers, that somehow mothers have to identify with quite different and often enemy children and people. And that's something that doesn't come out of maternal thinking itself. I do think there's a basis in maternal thinking for a kind of particular identification with other mothers, because mothers do have to identify with their children. And their children are very, very different from them. And they have to identify with children's friends sometimes, who can seem weird and threats to their children. And so mothers do, in their own work, have to learn to identify with and connect with and speak a voice, give voice to differences without breaking connection. But still, it's a tremendous leap to be able to say, I identify with your child when... your child is the child of somebody you take as the enemy, or your government takes as the enemy, or your people take as the enemy. So that's right within maternal thinking, and I think the biggest challenge of maternal thinking, and cannot be put down to women's power in the world. I think the other biggest thing is that women have, over the years, trusted to the authority of governments and men to make decisions about danger, and have not looked closely enough at alternatives to violence and at where those dangers come from. And that does have to do with powerlessness.
Our guest this morning is Sarah Ruddick. She teaches philosophy and women's studies at the New School for Social Research. She is the author of the book Material Thinking Toward a Politics of Peace. And there we're talking about some of the ideas contained in the book. If you perhaps have some thoughts that have been triggered by some things that we have said, you'd like to express your own opinions or perhaps ask some questions, you're welcome to do that. We just have about 10 minutes left in our program this morning. The number locally, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here on the toll free line. We'll talk with them.
Hello?
Yes, hello?
Wait, I'm calling regarding your the thesis you have brought up of a child being brought here by a mother, and it is hers. But in most cases, a mother can't fulfill all the teaching and the planning in a child's life, which can be given to him or her in the schools. And I'm referring to the private schools. I think there is a lot of nurturing and learning that a child needs for life. And I even see that. The schools I went to were like that, and I see that even today, in the schools. I have a cousin who has quite a large family, and she's very careful about the schools she enrolls them in, because she knows that they're going to be given the necessary facts that they need to know and the learning for life, which often a mother can't do. Would you not agree?
Yes, I certainly agree with that. I mean, mothers need schools, mothers need doctors, mothers need all sorts of people to support and supplement and expand their work. I think teachers is very interesting because a lot of teaching of children has a maternal element. And a lot of teachers are, in fact, mothers who have engaged in maternal thinking and think maternally. But teaching isn't the same as maternal thinking. And what teachers do is certainly different from and necessary and expansive on mothers. The one thing I'd like to see is a more fruitful alliance between teachers and mothers, especially mothers of young children, where I think very often you find teachers can be quite contemptuous of mothers and their insights into their children, and can even make mothers feel rather terrible and incompetent. So I'd like to, but I believe that there should be a very strong alliance between mothers and teachers all along the line, and the teachers are absolutely necessary. And again, especially the teaching of teachers of young children are underrated and underappreciated, just as mothers are.
The whole scene seems like an alliance between the teachers and the mothers, but I do think that the teachers do, and you know, take a tremendous responsibility and fulfill a role that the mothers well, they just leave off there, and the teachers take over for 8 years in the elementary school. Then there's the high school and the college.
Yeah,
and you just can't drop them off at just any school that they're. Maybe there's 56 children in the class itself or something. A teacher that type, how can she do it, you know?
No, it has to be, it's not that, like, mothers drop off and teachers take over. It has to be a kind of continual alliance, and most people's children aren't in private schools.
I know.
And I think I believe it's not just mothers need teachers, but mothers need neighborhoods, and they need communities.
Oh, yes.
And they need city governments. Who are committed to providing the schools.
Well, see, now this is a problem that's going on in the Chicago. I don't live in Chicago, but I live 40 miles out of Chicago. But there's a problem there amongst the public schools that they're overcrowded. And there's a tremendous problem. They're working on that now and trying. There are the state house in Springfield. They're working on that all the time, trying to, increase the value of these schools in Chicago.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your call very much. I have somebody else who is holding on here, and I want to make sure that we get to them before we end up running out of time. Let me go over to our line number one for another caller. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm ashamed to admit that I missed the first part of the show, so you may have covered this, but It's in the context of what you just said about women sometimes surrendering power to the authorities, the government, and I guess my comment comes from a young Catholic mother I know who's like supermom, and she brought this argument against abortion to me, that it's a violence done to women and children by men, I guess. And I was just wondering what you thought about that. I'm not really sure how I feel about it myself, so I kind of appreciate any input.
Well, about what I call the right to choose, I feel very strongly. I feel that birth giving should be a chosen project, and that a woman who engages in birth should engage in it knowing its particular pleasures and its particular responsibilities, and should make a commitment to that project. Anybody who takes away, on my view now, anyone who takes away or even diminishes her capacity to thoughtfully choose and take responsibility for a project, not only endangers her, but often also her infant, who may not get the care, who may in fact even be assaulted by drugs or whatever, that would be given an infant if a birth giver were told very early that this was a choice with pleasures, rewards, and responsibilities, but that must be thoughtfully made. The other thing I do feel about the abortion controversy, I mean, I feel this very, very strongly, I also feel that people like me and people like your friend must somehow learn to talk to each other about what we feel, and to respect the differences between us and the ways we came to those differences. So I don't want to put my view, which I hold strongly, march for, organize for, and so on, in a way that is disrespectful to your friend or to you or to anyone who has a different metaphysics, really, who believes that abortion is the murder of a person. I don't believe that. And and as I say, my whole way of thinking is quite different, namely that birth giving must be a chosen project, and that finally only a birth giver can make that choice, because only she can take care of herself in the ways that are necessary both for her own good and for her infant's good, and that she will do that in consultation with anyone that can help her make that choice, and she should be able to turn. I hate to see her making that choice alone, but she should be able to turn to whatever teachers and counselors, parents, whoever can really listen to her struggle to whether to make that choice thoughtfully.
I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We're very short on time, and my lines are full, and I would like to, again, try to include one or possibly two more people before we finish.
Okay, I'll be very short this
okay.
time.
Okay, we'll go to next to line number two. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I thank the speaker for having done her homework in women's studies, and how she's explained it's a very comprehensive view, not simply just limited to abortion. I don't know if the speaker is aware of this community's status on women's studies that we have at both at the university and at Parkland. I took a course at the university, and that cost just one course comes to about $750, and most homemakers, and I'm finished with raising children, cannot pull out $750 for state college. So we also have a junior college, or a community college, Parkland, and they are offering four courses, and they are also giving the this is a critical time as to whether the director of the women's studies program at Parkland is going to be no longer hired. And August 23rd is the meeting of our Parkland Board of Trustees that we've elected, and our Parkland president. And I'm wondering how maybe our speaker can answer the question of why a director would be important for people to get to more than just the formal classes, to be able to get to community offerings that are made that we women who have been alone raising our children haven't had an opportunity to pursue.
Well, I certainly think a director of women's studies and women's studies itself is an enormous blessing for women and men, and that it does provide a place for women especially to come to understand their
lives in the world, the options that they have, the roads that have been blocked and can be opened, and that they can come to thoughtfully make the choices they need to make about mothering, about birth giving, about fighting in the military, about policies in the workplace, healthcare in the workplace, about the environment, all of those places. All these things are done in women's studies in a way that I don't think they're done anywhere else, for women and by women.
One more caller we'll be able to take here on our toll-free line. Hello?
Hi. You were talking about mothers not being instinctively equipped to rear children, and today's mothers are often ignorant about child-rearing. But historically, when our society was more traditional, and especially when the extended family was strong, there was abundant folk knowledge about child-rearing. And in dealing with new mothers, I find that new mothers still look to their mothers for early child-rearing knowledge. And later in their child-rearing experience, they may want their mothers to butt out. But when they're faced with a new baby, they often turn to their mothers for advice on how to rear this new baby. Do you find that?
Yes, and I think, as I said before, I think that girls especially learn maternal thinking because they identify with their mothers and to some extent have learned it by the time they have children, but only to some extent. And boys who identify with their mothers who have had men fathers who have been mothering have also learned it and have up to a certain extent. The only thing is, I hate to say this too confidently, because whatever I do, if I were in an audience, people would come up and tell me that their mothers were terrible. I certainly believe I learned so much from my mother that mothering would have been impossible without what I learned from her. So I agree with you that it's there. I still think that in women's studies programs, in the schools, that we need to understand the institutions of mothering and the way mothering is idealized and the costs that women mothers especially have to pay for mothering that needn't be. And we must change the social conditions of mothering, I think.
We must stop there because we're out of time. Thank you very much, Professor Ruddick, for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Our guest is Sarah Ruddick, and if you're interested in reading some of her thoughts, you might take a look at her book, Maternal Thinking, Toward a Politics of Peace. Beacon Press is the publisher.